Hey, thanks for listening to Consumed with Scott Porch. On today's show, The Walking Dead. I have King Ezekiel himself, Kari Payton, and author Paul Vigna, who wrote a great book about the series last fall called Guts, The Anatomy of the Walking Dead. The second half of Season 8 premieres Sunday night on AMC. The Walking Dead introduced a community last season called The Kingdom that's like an English village on a PBS drama. There's a town square with a garden. There's a school. Guards ride the perimeter on horseback like medieval knights. The Kingdom is called The Kingdom because it has a king. King Ezekiel, played by actor Kari Payton. He presides in a throne room. He has a tiger. He has supreme confidence. He speaks like a Shakespearean actor calling people fair maidens and faithful stewards. As Paul Vigna, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, writes in his book Guts, The Anatomy of the Walking Dead, King Ezekiel is the platonic ideal of a philosopher king. People believe in Ezekiel and they believe in the kingdom. Kari Payton and Paul Vigna join me today on Consumed.
We shall face men. Some cornered into their roles by circumstance. Some desperate murderers thrilled by blood. We shall end them all. As is our charge this day. As is our sorrow. And yet I smile. We will leave our loved ones to traverse a dangerous road. Rushing out of peace into war. And yet I smile. For we will mine glory from the rock of struggle this day. We will honor and protect this bastion of life in a land of the dead. And we will win. You trust the king, we will win.
If you think about different characters serving different purposes on the show to viewers, like Rick in season one being sort of an audience point of view character for not knowing what's happening, what do you see Ezekiel serving as at the point he came into the show?
Well, I think pretty obviously the show needed some sort of hope, some sort of like window that there is a cause for some kind of hope and freedom and a place where you can feel human again. And in this world, you just lost, you know, two beloved characters in Glenn and Abraham. You know, you're seeing, you know, your heroes, you know, at their wits' end, darkest moments, or, you know, certainly one of their darkest moments. And I think Ezekiel represented a real turn there, that life isn't over, that there's reason to fight for something, and that you can live in this apocalypse, you know, no matter how bad it gets, you can find, you know, a way to go beyond just surviving. I would say that's it.
And do you see that mostly in the form of him being an optimistic character, or him projecting this sense of calm, that they've sort of built a wall around this world and things are calm on the inside?
Well, he literally had one of my lines I had in that first episode. He said to deal with all the bad, I had to go overboard with all the good. And I think that's a really telling message. You're literally in a world surrounded by living death, and in order to cope with that, you know, how do you survive? Do you try to think positively just a little bit, or do you really try to go overboard, because what's coming at you is already going overboard? You know, it's if something pushes you back you know, pretty significantly, you got to push back pretty hard. And I think that's what Ezekiel's doing, you know, and I think that's why people seem to be okay with his theatrics. It's because, you know, you need something to get your mind off of this thing, you know? I mean, we want respite from the real world. We go to a Renaissance fair. You know, their respite from the real world is a respite from you know, living death, you know, knocking down your doors and taking away your the people that you hold dear, you know. So a Renaissance type of medieval king may be the easiest way to go about something like that.
Paul, Ezekiel comes into the show at a time when the storytelling fractures to three and sometimes four different locations. How do you see all of those working together at that point in the story?
Well, in terms of the story itself, I thought it was pretty fascinating because, you know, as the character Jesus says, he says, your world is about to get a lot bigger. And I thought it was really interesting to see. And it's interesting when you contrast it with what's going on in Fear the Walking Dead. You end up with the two shows kind of showing a bunch of communities, but going in different directions. In Fear the Walking Dead, you have a lot of different communities, but they're all sort of splintering and fracturing and breaking down, and you're seeing things on the collapse. On Walking Dead, even though the timelines are different, on Walking Dead, you now have a situation where you are now seeing different communities start to come together. And obviously they're having a huge war about it, but you're just starting to see all these, you know, groups of survivors come together. And it's sort of an interesting progression from the beginning of the show, where it really was just focused on a small group of people who were almost going from house to house. Then it was from temporary shelter to temporary shelter. Now the one group, Rick's group and the Alexandrians, they found a permanent shelter, and then they find other groups. And so you're starting to see, you know, society put itself back together. And I think that's a really fascinating sort of long-term dynamic to explore on the show, as messy and bloody as it can be.
You know, I wrote about season 7 for Playboy largely as an experiment in governance, you know, that Rick, as this almost George Washington-like figure, trying to sort of wrestle through the layers of democracy and decision making and control and military and these various things, and then King Ezekiel and Negan being sort of at one end the benevolent monarch and at the other end the authoritarian dictator. And I'm not exactly sure, by the end of the season, or maybe even up to this point in the middle of season 8, if the show has taken a position on which of those forms of government makes the most sense. Do either of you have any observation of whether the show's taken a position on that?
Well, I don't know if the show's taken a position on that. I do think it's kind of interesting that the Walking Dead storyline has been kind of a circuitous march on Washington, in a way, you know, literally, it's making its way toward the Capitol slowly but surely, which is kind of interesting. Maybe one day we'll cross the Potomac. I don't know, but as far as of course, I am extremely biased, you know, but I would say that King Ezekiel had a pretty good handle on his way of living before, and I would even say that although it's not ideal to have any, you know, I guess cult of personality be your form of government, at least the people of the kingdom kind of lucked out with Ezekiel and, you know, having a benevolent attitude towards his rank, I guess, among his people. But even in war, had he not gotten bad information about those two sets of 50 cal guns sitting in that perch, King Ezekiel would have been probably the most effective warrior, war leader also in this whole thing. Yeah, there was those guns weren't supposed to be there, and that's literally the only thing he didn't take out. If we're looking right, back at it, I'm just saying, check the record.
Well, one thing I think is interesting too is if you look at Ezekiel and Negan, Ezekiel is clearly, he's almost the platonic ideal of the philosopher king. And Negan is an obvious despot and totalitarian. But in some way, if you look at it in certain angles, they're not that far off.
They
are. Each of them obviously is the undisputed ruler of their community. Mm-hmm. Each of them has built a pretty stable community until mm-hmm. they go to war and we see who's more powerful. Each of them has built a pretty stable community that works for the people in it. I think it's.
I would say almost look wrong at, there. I don't know if it works for the people in it in the as far as the sanctuary is concerned. I think it's stable in a sense. But one dude who's the only dude with wives. I don't know if it works for everyone in it. But I would say that they're both theatrical personalities, and that they drive and you think of Ezekiel as this obviously theatrical, but honestly, before Ezekiel, who was more theatrical than Negan? You know,
right.
His was absolutely a cult of personality, and you can't rule an entire group, with a bloody bat. You know, that's a psychological hold that you end up having over people.
Do you fit Rick between the two? I mean, in some ways, I think of Rick as more similar to Negan, but with a more of a moral compass than Negan, and in some ways. Similar to Ezekiel, but maybe with less personality than Ezekiel.
Yeah, I think I don't know what's happening. Here, sorry about that. It's a phone over here. I'm not aware of. I feel like I wouldn't put Rick with. In Negan's category, I think Negan went running. Well, you know, ran to be the that this was a world and a society where he had the right to kill people, and he takes incredible pleasure in it. And I think that's a big difference. And to glom Rick into that category, I think he is incredibly reluctant to a fault. He's sometimes reluctant to be brutal, and then it ends up being that might have been the better course of action. But for many times, I feel like it was he was trying desperately to save the lives of one, and ends up losing the lives of many.
Well, and Rick has been pretty brutal with outsiders at times, and I know that comes from security concerns about the safety of the group, someone coming in. But I mean, he's been very closed off to other people, I guess, to make a diplomatic analogy. He's been a fairly closed society.
Closed off is one thing, you know, homicidal is another, it's yeah. And I think that's a distinction that we need to remember. I take a lot of umbrage at the idea that Negan, had we been telling him his story from the beginning, we'd see him as a good guy. I don't see that as the case. I mean, I like Vic Mackey of the Shield. I never saw him as a good guy. You know what I mean?
One thing I thought was really fascinating in the first half of season 8, and I think Kari, you did a phenomenal job in acting out the role. But one thing I thought was really, really interesting is there was an earlier line that Gavin had said where he says, you know, Ezekiel, there's no kings, there's no presidents, there never was. And later, as Ezekiel's men are chopped down and your army is decimated, eviscerated, really, and as Ezekiel himself is broken down as a man, what I think was really, really fascinating, and it kind of translates into the real world, is how much of our leadership is really made up of myth, and how much it is a myth that we are sold and we believe because we need to believe in something, we need to see something. And it was just amazing to watch that process be just totally ripped apart with Ezekiel.
Well, and Carol was a big marker for that for Ezekiel. I mean, if you remember the first introduction of Carol and Ezekiel, she essentially laughed in his face when he was introduced as the king. And to come around to the middle of season 8, where she's telling him, you are the king, you're the leader of this group.
Yeah.
Those people need King Ezekiel. And if you can't be the king, then do what you do best and play the part. I have to act every day. It used to bother me, but this is who I am, and I am still standing. I just have to act like everything is normal until it is. It's what they need, and it's what you have to give them.
Whether we are talking about religion or government, we've made these things. A group of people have come together and decided that these are the rules that we're going to play by. But even this bicameral system of government that's our government, that's the law of the land. It hasn't always been this way. People came together and made these rules, and we built a society out of that. All of these things started from somewhere, but it was but none of these things are intrinsically what we're about. You know, there are a lot of options. And these are the options that they're playing with. But just like, you know, people would say that, you know, when that Ezekiel's, you know, kind of, you know, living this fake personality and this kind of a lie. And it's like this is no more of a lie than the Supreme Court having authority is a lie. We give it authority, and therefore it has authority. You know, there was a monarch that was the king or queen of England, and it may have looked ridiculous to some, you know. And now and at this stage, you know, in our history, you know, the queen, you know, has a certain status, but she is no longer a governor. And so her actually ruling over the, you know, empire of the United Kingdom would seem ridiculous. It wasn't, though. It's all a construct, you know, that we're given to it. And so
that to me is an undercurrent of The Crown that I wonder if people watching The Crown in the UK and other parts of the world even see. I mean, I've only seen the first season, but I watched that first season and think, what, you know, does anyone question what role she has in any of this? It seems to not come up the way it would to an American.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's funny because the difference between how an American sees a monarch versus someone from the UK, obviously Lenny James, who plays Morgan, is British. And there was a small thing that was going on. We were not a small thing, but a moment in the story of The Walking Dead where there were a bunch of grocery carts that were blocking the way, and the Knights of the Kingdom all rushed out to push them aside, and I went to go help push the carts. And Greg Nicotero was like, "No, Kari, you know, you don't push the carts." I was like, "I'm not that kind of king, man." I was yelling, "I'm not that kind of king." And he was like, but Lenny looked at me and he was like, "But you are the king. But you are the king." And he's got a different side. Like in America, we see the royal family, you know, and it's interesting and fun to watch the, you know, the machinations. There's something deeply intrinsic and an ownership of the royal family in England. And when Lenny told me, "You're a king, and there's a difference between, you know, you and it's important to us that we push the things aside for you. You know, it gives us a purpose."
You bring up Greg Nicotero. That's someone I was curious about asking both of y'all about, and your different perspectives of him as a really one of the major voices of the series as a producer, as a director, as one of the minds behind the look and the way the walkers are put together and the way they function. What comments would y'all have on Greg's contribution to the series?
Well, Greg has an incredible energy about him when it comes to the zombies and the practical effects, and his mind is always racing. He's always got ideas. He's such a student of the genre and a lover of those kinds of films. But what one thing that I don't think people understand about Greg is because he's immersed himself in this stuff, and also because of his incredible energy for it. I mean, when we're spewing blood out of somebody's you know, chest cavity and it's just flying here and there, I've never seen, you know, a man so like a kid in a candy store in my life than Greg, you know, trying to capture, you know that moment just right, you know, especially in a practical effect. You know, he's literally running and trying to see it from every angle and make sure that we've got it. But but there is also something to be said for how fast we have to work on this show. The amount of problems you have to fix in order to make it look good and make it look right and get it done quickly is an incredible problem and obstacle to have to overcome each and every week. And but it's something. I mean, we were just talking about it this week. I was at a convention with him, and I was like, "Are we going to get dinner?" And he was like, "No, that's not true." I said, "Are you going to come gamble with me?" And he said, "said no. I've got to figure out. I've got a big problem to fix on Fear the Walking Dead, and I got 24 hours to figure out how I'm going to do it, and that." is one of the great talents that he has.
Paul, what kind of figure did you see him as you were working on the book?
The thing I think is interesting about Greg, maybe a lot of people do or don't know, is that he kind of has the, no pun intended, he's got the bloodlines going back to George Romero. He got his start as an assistant to Tom Savini, who was really the special effects guru on the Romero films, all the later ones. So Greg got his start as an assistant to Savini. I think it was Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
So he has that, you know, he goes back to the original, to the Romero days. And the thing I think, you can look at a lot of what has been done in Walking Dead and you can see Romero, Nicotero's fingerprints. The thing I thought was most interesting was in this half of season 8, where the zombie threat has really become something in the background. That clearly, all the characters are not afraid of the zombies now. They know how to deal with it. I mean, it's really much more of a nuisance than, you know, this thing that's just going to kill everybody. But what I really appreciated about this first half of season 8 was in every episode, there was at least one or two scenes that had great zombie effects in them. Even if the zombies weren't in it for long, there were some great zombies And you could see, I think it's Kari, what you were saying. You can see how much Greg loves that and how much he keeps bringing it.
Like, absolutely.
Even when the zombies aren't a major part of it, he makes sure that there are some good zombies in there for the people that appreciate that.
The, yeah. The Winston zombie, Jadis's spiky-headed zombie.
Oh, yeah.
Whimsy. Just pure whimsy. Yeah. Just a delight is sounds like a weird word to use for a walker on this show, right. But just a pure delight to watch this character come to life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean the toxic sludge zombies that Kara, you were in that, they were great. Yeah. They're nasty and putrid and disgusting. That was perfect.
And details that go with that there's just, instead of like red, you know, and red blackened spatter, you know, it's white, you know, yellow, green ooze that you know, when I swipe at him, across the face with the sword, it's, you know, it's the pus, you know, toxic stuff that comes out. Yeah, I love that. I loved it.
Right.
Three people to me come to mind as having had career-making roles and then left the show to go on to other career-making roles, or not even left the show, I guess, in Danai's case, but Danai Gurira going to Black Panther, Sonequa Martin-Green going to Star Trek Discovery, and John Bernthal going to the Punisher. What kind of impact have you seen, even beyond those three people, of having been on the show impacting their careers?
I mean, those are the big three. You know, obviously, Bernthal and Sonequa has been just a revelation on Discovery, and I feel like it's kind of amazing to watch Danai. I've only seen Black Panther once, but I'll definitely see it again. But if you thought that Michonne was just like tailor made for her, I think Okoye, you know, was literally, you know, they used the same, clay, you know, mass, you know, to build that character for her is just amazing. That's the legacy of a show like this. You know, it's funny. I was telling my wife, I've been an actor for 20 something years, and I did a lot of voiceover. I also did a lot of pilots that didn't go anywhere. But I made a decent living, you know, as a sort of middle class actor in Los Angeles, and I told her, you know, I don't think I need a pilot. I think I need an introduction. And you know what would be great, babe? It'd be great if that introduction was on one of those Comic-Con shows. You know, the one of those Comic-Con shows, I feel like that's the way you want it, you know, would be a great way to do it. And I don't know if it was maybe a year and a half later, I find myself, you know, on The Walking Dead. And rather than it being, you know, kind of the end of my, the beginning and end of my career, it's such a jumping off point, you know.
How much has it changed the number of scripts and the types of scripts that are in your inbox since you've been on the show?
Yeah. Oh, it's changed exponentially. And unfortunately I don't have time to deal with very many of them, but it also gives me the ability to be really careful about what the next thing that I actually want to do. You know, Ezekiel, I think is a hard act to follow. And I don't want to follow it with just anything. You know, he's the kind of character that I feel like inspires people. And that's what I've always wanted to do as far as my work was concerned. And the next character I do, however he entertains and inspires, you know, in whatever form that is, I want to have the same sort of impact on me at first, so that I can, you know, do a good job of putting it out there.
You know, while we're on this topic, I'm wondering, because I've always wondered, like, not wondered, but I mean, you know, Andrew Lincoln, Norman Reedus, Melissa, like all of them obviously have had their career trajectories changed. Kari, how much downtime do you have to even do other projects? Because what I'm, the point I was making is I'm kind of surprised that I haven't seen Norman Reedus do more or Andrew Lincoln do more. I mean, they obviously have so much visibility now. How much downtime do you really have to even pursue outside projects?
You really don't have much time. We've got a few months in between and, you know, seasons and, you know, and a lot of that's December. So, you know, so, you know, where everything kind of shuts down. I mean, you can wedge something in there. And if it, if you really want to make it happen, you know, like say with Denai, you know, one of the nice things about shooting in Atlanta is that Black Panther was right there, you know, for her to be able to, you know, she could shoot Walking Dead one day and I'll be asking her where she's going to be the next few days, and she'll be shooting Panther, you know, just a few minutes down the road. So so you know, so those things are kind of perfect that you know, kind of the way that that happened. But for guys like Andy and Norman, who really do, you know, have this show on their shoulders, there really isn't a whole lot of time. Especially, I mean, Norman's also shooting his own show, the motorcycle kind of travel show, a ride. Between those two, I don't think he's got much else left. And I think the time off that Andy does have is pretty precious with the these kids. I think 7 and 10, you know, years old. And so and now that they're in school, he's, you know, they spend a lot of time, you know, away. So I think that that time's pretty precious to him.
Paul, one of the things that jumped out at me at the book is about the ratings. That I think you said in the book, the average ratings for season one were 5 million. And by season five, it was 17 million. And it has trailed back down some since then. Do you, I mean, there's a lot of factors, but do you attribute that more to macro media factors?
Yeah, I do. I think there are two trends. Well, maybe there actually it's probably one trend, really. They're related. I mean, you see a lot of TV ratings are down, and I think that's because people's viewing habits are changing. I remember I interviewed Cliff Curtis at one point for talking about Fear the Walking Dead, and he said something I thought was interesting to me. He said, "We really don't know who's watching anymore." I think the ratings were always sort of an imperfect vehicle, but they were the best thing that networks had to use. So they just used them, and everyone came to believe them. But now you're at a point where, you know, people are watching on demand. People are watching. People are pirating the stuff. People are watching on their computers, on their phones, on it. You know, it's not just people sitting down in front of the television. And that trend has taken off in the last few years. And I think that is reflected in not only the ratings for Walking Dead, but the ratings for the NFL and the ratings for a lot of other programs.
Sure.
So I think that's probably the bigger issue. I would say I wouldn't be surprised if a smaller issue, though, is that, you know, people do wear out and get tired. And, you know, look, I'm one of the lunatic 11 million that will watch this show every single episode until the day they drag it off the air, no matter what. But not everybody is that dedicated. And, you know, 5 or 6, 7 years of zombies and blood and guts, I think some people probably did get a little tired of it. Just to be honest.
And off its peak, it was still, I think, the second highest rated show on cable, or the highest rated show on cable.
I think it's still the highest rated show
not counting HBO, right?
Yeah.
Well, HBO, I don't even think the stories are highly exaggerated. But it's I think a little fatigue is understandable. I also do think that the amount of people that come to me and talk to me and are like and are literally like, don't tell me anything, I can't watch it until it comes on Netflix, you know, and you know, but they're fans, and fans enough to get up and come to a convention and pay to see all of this stuff, you know, but they're waiting, you know, versus, you know, some people who don't watch until, they've got time on a Wednesday afternoon. And, there's so many people, the DVR has changed the way that we view these things, but still it doesn't change the phenomenon that it is. And, I mean, in my hometown of Athens, Georgia, my dad would go to a movie theater where they let people in and watch the show for free every Sunday night for the past 5 years. And wow. It's a thing that they know that there's. I literally have to call to make sure my dad's got a reserved seat it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, you mentioned the conventions, Kari. I mean, I was actually amazed by the dynamic that I saw at those conventions and how popular they are and how many people go to them. And you talk about the dedicated fans. I mean, yeah. And Scott, you talked about people having careers, like even people who are on one episode, people who are in zombie makeup, people who are, they are at these conventions constantly and they have fans. They have people that want to see them. I mean, it's not just people like Kari who are, stars, top line talent. It's everybody. And
that little girl with that teddy bear, the first walker that was ever killed on that show, she has a following.
Addie Miller, right?
Jeffrey Dean Morgan told me for the Playboy, the 20 Questions interview last year, that he still gets recognized for Supernatural. He was on season two or something of Supernatural.
Supernatural is a supernatural phenomenon when it comes to fandom. When it comes to fantasy comic book fandom, there is a difference. There is something that happens in the psyche of a human being when they relate to sci-fi fantasy, because that's literally how these comic conventions have grown into the thing that they've been. It kind of started with Star Trek and grown from there, but there are supernatural conventions, just Supernatural, the show. Supernatural.
That makes me wonder why AMC has been relatively conservative with the show. I mean, you look at something like the New York series of Marvel Netflix shows, they've got 4, 5, 6 of those going at one time between Luke Cage and Iron Fist and Jessica Jones and all of those shows, and making dozens and dozens of episodes within that universe. Why do you think AMC has been relatively conservative in just having two shows? There's no streaming show. There's no feature films. There's no theme park.
Well, I think.
Well, there are those things. There are theme parks, but they're licensed. You can go to Universal Studios and get scared by zombies, I think it's a slower trickle. I would say that it is a slower. But I'm sorry. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, one of the things that most surprised me when I think it was even before I started doing research for the book, I was writing for an article, as I was looking at ratings for The Walking Dead, and I realized that The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, The Talking Dead, not only are those all top 10 shows and top rated shows on Sunday nights, the 11 p.m. repeat of The Walking Dead, of the 9 p.m. show that comes on after Fear the Walking Dead, that's a top 10 rated show. So, I mean, you say AMC is being conservative, but I mean, they have 3 of the most watched hours on Sunday night, often going up against NFL, Sunday night football. I mean, you can say they're being conservative. They are crushing it with this property. I mean, they are really capitalizing on it. So I don't think they're actually being all that conservative. I mean, I think they are really capitalizing on it.
Kari, going into the back half of season 8, tell us some things we should be paying attention to, some ideas we should be receptive to in these last 8 episodes.
No, I will not.
and thank you. And thank you for not doing that.
My gosh.
I don't want to know.
It's going to be a great ride, you know, that's gonna tear your heart out and somehow push it back into your chest and sew it up, and so that you can still live on but feel the pain of it, you know, long after it's gone, you know. But it's one of those shows that the struggle is important, you know. It's like it's like a football game, you know. It's if it was a blowout, it just wouldn't be as much fun, you know. It's like you gotta pay for the win, I think that's why it catches on and holds people so much. I always think back to this woman who I was at a show in convention in San Antonio, and she drove up from McAllen, Texas, I think, which is down on the border. And it's a full day to drive across Texas to get anywhere. And she gave me a hug, and she held on, and she just burst into tears, and she was just like, it's just been so hard. And I don't know what she was talking about. She said, it's just been so hard, but I turn you guys on and I see you struggling along with me, you know. It's just been so hard, and just thanks for the, you know, for that. And that's the thing that people come back to for me when one of the things that I was surprised by in the last few weeks or a couple of months, I guess, since we've had the mid-season finale, is that I've had dozens and dozens of people come to me with And Yet I Smile tattooed somewhere on their bodies.
Wow.
And it's like it's cancer patients. It's people dealing with depression. It's, you know, it's people who are just like, you know what? I say this to myself when I think, you know, when I just, you know, am really pissed off at the state of the world or whatever. You know, it's like those little moments are the things that I think stick with people, you know?
Well, Kari, if you can't give me a preview of the back half of season 8, at least give me a good Jerry as King Ezekiel.
Jerry, I'm hoping it'll be a big smile and a Jerry. You know, I love Jerry so much. I hate that Ezekiel would always give him such a hard time. But it was always put down the cobbler.
Jerry and Carl are my two favorite one-liners from the show. Carl,
you know what? To be in the same conversation with Carl is a huge compliment. Thank you.
Well, guys, I really appreciate y'all. Appreciate you talking to me. I'm very much looking forward to Sunday night. I've got the screener for the first episode, and I've been putting off watching it, thinking I might actually just watch it live on Sunday night. And good luck on the rest of the season. And Paul, are you going to do a new version of the book if things keep changing and there's new seasons and the show keeps running? Have you talked to your publisher at all about
We haven't, but I will say with Carl getting bitten, and obviously we know what's going to happen when you get bitten, that already blew my theory of the show's end out of the water. So I may at least need to update the last chapter of the book where I tried to predict what was going to happen. But I would certainly do another book if the show runs for long enough and things change enough. I would at least do a new version of it, new edition.
Do you see it going that way, like a Grey's Anatomy, or like a show that runs 14, 15, 20 seasons?
I mean, I think the ratings will always be there, so AMC is not going to kill the show. They could lose half the audience and still be a huge show on cable. So I don't see AMC ever getting tired of that. I think the real issue would only be whether, you know, people like Kari and people like the creative team still want to do it and still have the energy to do it. As long as you guys are into it and you love it and you care about it and you bring that same enthusiasm, you're going to have an audience. So as long as those
stories are compelling, I think you know people be interested in doing it. I will say this without any spoilers. I think Maggie character said, the future is ours. You know, with Carl, you know, getting bit, I know that that feels less so, but I would just say the future is still ours.
Yeah. Three things quickly I'm looking forward to in the back half of season 8. One, I want to see Ezekiel put himself back together. I'm interested in seeing how that dynamic goes. Two is Maggie. I want to see how Maggie evolves as a leader at Hilltop. It looks like, you know, she is really becoming a force to be reckoned with, and that'll be fascinating.
Well, and if you read the trades, Lauren Cohan has not signed for season 9 yet.
Oh, don't even do that to me. This is going to sound demented, but I'm really excited to see vengeful Rick again. Rick from season 5 that metes out justice in this world. I think he is going to be so destroyed by what happened to Carl that he is going to go back into that, you know, fighting the cannibals mode. I like that Rick. I want to see that Rick. I want more of that Rick.
Well, and Jeff Morgan told me even before Negan had been on the show that at least 2 seasons was what he said. So I'm curious to see now whether that means 2 seasons or whether that means at least 2 seasons.
Yeah, sure.
All right, guys. Well, I really appreciate you talking to me, and looking forward to Sunday night.